but told me it's my fate to help kill Aemon. She hadn't asked for my help. She hadn't even asked if I want to do this, though it might prove fatal to me. She'd simply stated that I would do it, because it had been foretold. How is that fair to me? What about what I want? I sigh, blowing my hair from my face as I tap my pen against the wooden table. Hours of thinking, and all I have to show for it is a mounting headache and conflicting information. Flipping the pages of the notebook, I stop at my list of questions as I circle the most important of them all, and one Rhiannon had tried her best to circumvent. Who is my mother? And why would she have thought she was protecting me by leaving Fairydale with me? By my calculations, she should be a member of the six families, but which? Wouldn't Rhiannon have told me already if she was a Hale? The more I ruminate about that question, the more I realize there is only one person who can give me an answer. The only one who'd straightforwardly told me he knew my mother and could tell me more about her. Archibald Nicholson. Deciding I need to take matters into my own hands, I put on a sundress and a light blazer since the weather has turned chilly. Fiddling with the red bracelet Rhiannon had placed upon me, I have to wonder if this will help me in any way, or if it isn't a veiled threat. Maybe I've become a little paranoid in my time in Fairydale, but everyone has their own agenda. Aside from Rhiannon's worry that some creature might get its hands on my blood and jeopardize her plans, I doubt she cares much about what happens to me. The only one who's been there for me from the beginning has been Caleb. He's the only person who's gone far and beyond to help me, and seems to have my well-being at heart. Though I've had moments in the past where I've doubted him, due to my own mental failings, I now realize that he's only ever been frank with me, including the fact that I shouldn't blindly trust his family. A sudden wave of melancholy hits me when I think of him, and I wonder how long his business will keep him away. In such a short time, he's become my rock. It's a little unsettling to realize that not only have I come to depend on his company, but crave it like an addict. You'd better come home soon, Caleb, I mutter under my breath as I comb my hair, plaiting it in a simple braid. Since he's not here, I will have to walk to town, where I will need to inquire about Mr. Nicholson's address. Maybe it's a little rude of me to come thus unannounced, but he had previously invited me to dinner, so I hope he won't be too bothered. Once I'm ready, I head out, carefully making my way towards the town. A light breeze brushes my skin as the sun hides behind the clouds. Gazing at the sky, I hope it's not going to rain anytime soon, at least not while I'm so far away from town. Increasing my pace, I can't help but notice that the clouds are becoming darker and darker, a loud sound echoing in the sky. Pulling my blazer tighter around my body, I try to maintain my body heat as the atmosphere changes. The temperature suddenly drops. Nothing is happening. Nothing is happening, I chant to myself as I pass by the old church and what's left of 12 Astor Place. Until now, I'd only seen it in passing from the car, but as I take in the charred wood and the barely standing structure, I cannot possibly imagine how I would have made my way out onto the lawn where Caleb had found me. Goodness, but that was such a narrow encounter with death. The moment that thought arises, though, I have to wonder if I can actually die. Since my injuries heal on their own, does that mean that I am invincible? Will I even grow old since my cells will just heal themselves? Once more, I am overwhelmed with questions. I hadn't taken the time to consider the implications of my newly found abilities before, but now that the seed has been planted, I can see the countless possibilities. Lost in my thoughts, I startle as a bolt of lightning whips across the sky, branching out in smaller lines as it takes over the entire visible horizon. A shiver goes down my back at the sudden change in weather, especially since it had been perfectly fine when I left the house. Even more suspicious is the fact that these sudden changes in weather have happened before, Like when I'd first arrived in Fairydale. Could it be that Aemon can control the sky? My brows pinch together in worry as the wind picks up, blowing right in my direction. Right at that moment, lightning strikes in front of me, the bolt hitting the road and causing the ground to quake and shatter at the point of impact. Startled, a panicked cry escapes me as I jump back. At the same time, more loud noises erupt in the sky and all around me. My mind becomes a huge void as fear overtakes me. Out of nowhere, a scratchy sound resounds before something attacks me, tackling me to the ground. I'm so stricken with fear that I fail to realize the thing is not attacking me. Rather, it's licking me. Mr. Meow? My voice wobbles as I struggle to gain control over my shaking body. I take a deep breath, and when even that doesn't help, I continue to breathe in and out while Mr. Meow languidly licks my cheek before he nuzzles his furry face against mine. It's just you, Mr. Meow. I finally sigh in relief when I manage to clear the fog of fear. The storm is still brewing, and gathering myself off the ground, I cradle Mr. Meow to my chest as I walk faster and faster, barely short of a run, towards town. Mr. Vaughn had said Astor Place was 15 minutes away from town. Despite the rumbling thunder and the flashing lightning, I managed to get there in half the time. I barely feel my legs when I make it to the town center. My lungs constrict in my chest, my breathing intensifying. We're here, I whisper to the cat in my arms. Despite his absence, I'm happy to have come across him again. At least now I'll have someone else to keep me company while Caleb is away. I'll have to ask first if I'm allowed to house a pet in the manor. Though if they won't allow me, I'll hide Mr. Meow somehow. Oddly enough, the moment I enter one of the shops in the town square, the clouds suddenly dissipate as if there had been no storm. Biting my lip in consternation, I can only hope that whatever was after me is gone for good. Excuse me. I put on a polite smile as I enter the small shop. I was wondering if you could tell me where Mr. Nicholson's residence is? The clerk looks up, surprised to see me. Although Mr. Nicholson had assured me he'd put in a good word for me, I'm still worried that the townsfolk blame me for everything that happened. Oh, you're Miss Darcy, aren't you? The older woman bursts out, her face breaking into a genuine smile. I nod tentatively. It's so good to finally meet you. Archibald has told us all about you. She starts, getting up from her seat and coming towards me. Anyone who comes as highly recommended as you is welcome here. Thank you, I murmur. Unusually chatty and helpful, the woman takes out a map of Fairydale, showing me the exact route to Mr. Nicholson's house. Before I leave, I find out just how well-respected the man is in the entire town. He's helped all of us at some point. Everything you see built in this town, Mr. Nicholson and his family did it. The clerk recounts, sharing that most small businesses have a personal relationship with Mr. Nicholson and his family. You'll be in good hands with him, she says as I head out, thanking her for everything. Mr. Meow is getting increasingly more agitated. Don't worry, I'll ask Mr. Nicholson if he has something for you to eat. It can't have been easy for you these days. I coo lightly. I'm sorry I didn't look for you more. His paw is on my cheek, his claws sheathed as he gently strokes my skin. I give him an indulgent smile, patting him on the white spot on his head. Guiding myself with the map the clerk had given me, I follow a serpentine road before I reach an imposing house. It's not as big as the Hale Manor, but it speaks of the same type of grandiosity with its neoclassical facade and the entrance that simulates the Roman Pantheon. I swallow hard as a wave of nervousness hits me, not only because my surroundings are a little gloomy, but also because I'm coming here unannounced. Before I can chicken out, I push my chin up, straightening my spine and marching forward. With Mr. Meow in one arm, I use the other to knock on the thick bronze door knocker. Stepping back, I simply wait. It's not long before someone opens the door. It's a woman in her 50s or 60s, and upon taking a good look at me, a bright smile stretches across her face. "You must be Miss Darcy," she exclaims, clapping her hands together. How is it that everyone already knows who I am in this town? Yes, I nod awkwardly. "Mr. Nicholson has told me all about you. He knew you'd be calling on us at some point. Do come in," she says warmly, motioning me inside. "Let me grab your jacket, and if you'll follow me into the drawing room, I'll inform Mr. Nicholson of your arrival at once." She starts, taking my blazer and putting it on a hanger. "I do hope you're planning to stay for lunch. I'm making Mr. Nicholson's favorite stew." She drones on, her chatty disposition making me feel better about this impromptu visit. Leading me to the drawing room, she tells me to wait a moment as she calls on Mr. Nicholson. Nodding, I find my attention going back to Mr. Meow, who is getting more agitated by the second, baring his teeth for no reason at one of Mr. Nicholson's portraits. "Easy." I pull him close to my body. "We don't want to damage anything of worth around here. Until I get my inheritance, I have absolutely no money," I whisper in his ear. Once more, it dawns on me how silly I'm being. It's not as if he could understand what I'm saying, yet his body language tells me he does, that he's an intelligent animal, and he enjoys it when I address him directly.
"Meow!"
he screams at me, jumping out of my arms. Well, most times, anyway. Just as I'm about to get up and run after him, the sound of heavy steps stops me in my tracks. Mr. Nicholson appears in the doorway, his cane hitting the floor with a thud.
"Miss Darcy, how good to see you,"
he exclaims with good humor. My lips tip up in a smile. "Thank you for having me. I hope I'm not inconveniencing you."
Of course not."
He waves his hand.
"Helena will bring us tea. Let us have a seat,"
he says as he steps deeper into the room. Though I keep my eyes alert for Mr. Meow, I take a seat on the sofa opposite him, folding my legs to my right and straightening my spine, as Mr. Nicholson takes his seat, propping his cane by the side and away from my view. Helena bursts into the room with a tea tray. She's still chatting away, explaining that I will love the meal she's preparing and that she hasn't had a visitor to feed in a long time.
"You can retire, Helena,"
Mr. Nicholson adds after she'd served us each a cup of tea. "Of course, sir," she says blithely, so much so I expect her to skip out of the room, not walk. Yet her disposition puts me more at ease, thinking that you can tell a lot about the employer by how he treats his employees. And Helena seems to adore Mr. Nicholson.
"What brings you here, Miss Darcy?"
"I was wondering if we could continue our chat from last time. You said you knew my mother and father, and I would love to hear more if possible." He nods thoughtfully.
"Of course. I'll do my best to give you as much information as possible. What is it exactly that you want to know?"
"Who was my mother? I doubt her last name was O'Sullivan. No one so far has recognized it."
"Indeed,"
he drawls, taking a sip of his tea.
"I suppose she tried to pass herself as a respectable widow, is that not so?"
I nod. She'd always said my father had died before I was born.
"You would be correct. Her last name was not O'Sullivan."
He pauses.
"It was Nicholson."
My lashes flutter in befuddlement as I stare at him thoroughly confused. Nicholson, I repeat, swallowing hard. He nods grimly.
"She was my daughter,"
he confesses with a deep sigh. "What?" I squeak, my lips parting in shock.
I can't say I was always a good father.
He sighs.
I take full responsibility for that, but I never thought she would run away. Do everything in her power to ensure she wasn't found.
But I blink, slowly taking everything in.
I may have overreacted when I heard about her relationship with Leo. He was married at that time, and...
He purses his lips.
She could be very stubborn when she wanted to.
He shakes his head, sadness descending upon his features. Did you know she was pregnant when she left?
I suspected, but there was no way I could verify. It wasn't until much, much later that Mordecai told me he found the Swan brooch for sale. That's how we found out about you.
If you knew... I pause to choose my words carefully. After all, it's not every day you find out that you have a living grandfather, one who knew about your existence all along but did nothing. Just like Leo Pierce, Mr. Nicholson didn't think I was worthy, did he? If you knew, then why did you never come for me? At least visit or send a letter? I ask, doing my best to keep my voice from breaking. I was all alone, and I'm sure at least one letter would have made a world of difference. He flattens his lips in a grim line as he regards me, his eyes full of sorrow.
I'm sorry. I wanted to, but there's a reason I didn't. Just as there's a reason your mother decided to run with you.
And that is? I raise a brow, my tone more scathing than I would have liked.
If you're here, then I am confident Rhiannon Hale already told you about Lydia Hale's vision.
I frown, surprised he knows about it, but wondering about the connection.
She knew that if you grew up in Fairydale, you would be indoctrinated by the Hales, forced to listen to their agenda. She knew you would no longer have a choice, and that's what she wanted for you, Darcy. She wanted you to choose.
You know about the vision. But how... I trail off. Katrina had made it clear that the Hales and Nicholsons do not get along. Then how could he know?
Everyone is aware to an extent. There's a reason they aren't well-liked in town. They laid siege to that house and continued with their outrageous quest.
He says the last word with thorough disgust. By that, you mean to tell me you don't agree with them? Rhiannon told me there's an evil in Fairydale that needs to be eradicated, and that...
That you're going to do it?
He scoffs.
Plenty have tried before and have failed. What she wants is to lead to another set of deaths. It wasn't enough the first time.
He grumbles under his breath. Forgive me for prying, but are you part of the six families? His eyes narrow.
Yes.
He answers curtly.
Which is how I know their quest is madness personified. No one will survive another fight with that demon. I've tried to tell her countless times that we could fortify the seal in a similar ceremony without risking everyone, without risking you. But she won't have any of it.
I bite my lower lip as I regard him. There's something off about this entire situation, something that doesn't sit right with me, but I cannot pinpoint what. All I know is that both Rhiannon and Mr. Nicholson seem to have their own versions of the story, as well as different solutions. With their added conflict, I simply don't know which one to trust. But that doesn't mean I can't get more information. What's the difference between the rituals? I inquire.
The one Rhiannon wants to perform involves a forbidden spell that consumes life force, Darcy. The stronger the life force, the stronger the spell, which is why only the elders would be asked to perform it. And you.
I nod grimly. I'd been right to assume that the ritual would pose danger to my life, and if the original elders died trying to trap Aemon there, then I don't know how they would manage it this time and survive to see another day.
The ritual I suggested is a simple spell that requires a blood sacrifice.
He pauses when he sees my alarmed expression.
But not death. A simple offering to fortify the chains that keep the demon subdued, and your blood is powerful enough to do that.
I see, I reply slowly. His version of events contradicts what Rhiannon told me about not letting anyone get their hands on my blood, especially Aemon. Doubts continue to accumulate in my mind, but I don't let it show. Instead, I merely smile at him, nodding along.
So you see, we didn't want to reach out and expose you to this. At least not until you were at an age where you could make the decision for yourself. That was our intention. But then, Leo died, and...
He drifts off, his eyes full of sadness. I'm sorry about his passing. His death was horrible. Was it the demon that caused it? I probe carefully. Pursing his lips, he nods.
Just like he's caused every single odd death in the last 2 centuries. Just like he caused the plague.
The plague? I frown. He caused that too? My eyes narrow. Now that is something that Rhiannon had failed to mention. Surely if she thinks he's so evil, she would have told me that he killed people en masse with the plague in order to convince me to help her. Wouldn't she?
He did. Before the elders subdued him, he killed everyone from Fairydale to Ipswich and all the nearby villages. If they hadn't gotten there in time, I fear he could have wiped out the entire East Coast. Or more.
He releases a sad sigh in an attempt to convey his feelings on the matter. Yet why does it seem so forced? Why did I spot the slightest curl of his lip when he mentioned Aemon killed everyone? Dear God, but that's horrible. I cross myself, feigning a terrified expression. Two can play at this game. He might be my blood relative, but I have no allegiance to him, just as I have no allegiance to anyone in Fairydale. Funny, though, how everyone wants me, expects me, to help them. Where were they when I was 10 and wondering what would happen to me because the only person I'd had in the world suddenly left me all alone? Where were they when I spent my entire youth and teenage years trying to prove something because I felt expendable? Because I felt so grateful that the nuns had taken me in, that I transformed my entire life to suit their expectations. Where the hell were they when I was working myself to the bone during the day and crying myself to sleep at night? They were nowhere to be seen. Not Leo Pierce, not Mr. Nicholson, and not Rhiannon Hale. No one had been there for me, and I don't mean in a financial capacity, since it's clear that Leo had given money to the orphanage to keep me on. But they hadn't been there for me in the way that mattered the most, human to human. Now, they want me to risk my life for something I have absolutely no stake in. On the contrary, a part of me, the one that still loves Aemon, would never want to see him harmed in any way. Does that make me a bad person? Knowing he potentially killed hundreds of people, perhaps more, and yet I know I couldn't bring myself to harm him. If it does, then I'll acknowledge it as my fault. Maybe, just maybe, I am more wicked than I ever thought. But in light of everything I've found out so far, all conflicting and potentially misleading information, I can only conclude that everyone is underestimating me. Yes, I might be a little uptight, and maybe a little too set in my proper ways since I'd forced myself to become someone the nuns would be proud of, but I'm not stupid. And so far, everyone seems to assume I am. How could anyone do such a thing? I continue in the same horrified tone. This demon. I drop my voice to a whisper. Who is he? How is he capable of so much destruction? Just how? He nods emphatically, simulating my terror.
His name is Aemon. He's been in conflict with the Coven for centuries, maybe more. It all started when he absorbed the power of the First.
He starts recounting the same thing Rhiannon had told me, verbatim. But is there nothing more known about him? Why would he do such a thing to poor Elizabeth? He shakes his head.
He's evil, Darcy. His very essence is evil. How could you expect anything else from such a being? It's why we're here, to stop this from happening. But if we do it Rhiannon's way...
He shakes his head.
We're sacrificing good, powerful witches for something that might not even work.
I understand. I agree with you. Why should we take chances when we could reinforce the seal? His eyes flash at my statement, his mouth curling upwards. Interesting.
I'm glad you are a sensible woman, Darcy. I'm sure together we can make Rhiannon and the other elders see reason.
I give him a tight smile. Just out of curiosity, I add pensively, if I don't get involved at all, what will you do?
I will have to take drastic measures to stop Rhiannon from her folly. If I have to present my case in front of the elders, then so be it.
Sir, sir! Helena dashes into the room, an alarmed expression on her face. There's something wrong with the room. He tilts his head, awareness slowly seeping in, just as the blood seeps out of his face. Whatever room Helena is speaking about must be something very important, because no sooner had she said that than Mr. Nicholson is on his feet and going up the stairs, walking just fine, without his cane. I narrow my eyes at his form, oddly athletic for someone so old. Yet, just as that thought creeps into my head, so does something else. His cane. Right at that moment, the sun hits the jeweled top of the staff, its brilliance flashing into the entire room. Placing the teacup on the ground, I get to my feet, slowly advancing towards the precious stone. I no longer feel in control as I put one foot in front of the other, my eyes focused on the prize. As if possessed, I can't stop myself from reaching out and grabbing the cane. The stone shines even brighter, so much so it almost blinds me. Yet despite that, there's this unnatural compulsion to touch it, to feel it against my skin. The stone is a deep green that shines almost blue in the sunlight, and before I can help myself, I cup it with my entire palm. All at once, my entire body starts spasming, currents of electricity going through me until I no longer feel like myself. Until...
You can buy it, you know.
He whispers in my ear, his body fitted tightly behind me. I shake my head lightly as I gaze longingly at the gold necklace with its intricate floral design. I don't need more jewelry, I force myself to say.
You can always have more jewelry.
No, I say as I put the necklace down. Gradius tibia gimus. I nod to the seller, turning around and grabbing Aemon's hand as I lead him down the bustling street. Animals are running around freely, with people stopping every now and then to watch them with unabashed amusement. It's the fourth day of Ludi Flore, and the celebrations are already in full swing, the rituals taking most of the day, all in an effort to promote fertility of the land. With this occasion, the streets are cleaner, too, despite the sewer stench that I doubt will ever go away. After all, Rome is Rome, and cleanliness has never been its strong suit. Even so, it's been home for so long. I don't see us leaving any time soon, not with all the connections we've made with people and the land, and certainly not with the wonderful climate and the beautiful Tyrrhenian Sea. The sun is shining brightly in the sky, the smell of trees in bloom intoxicating as petals of flowers are swept away by the gentle breeze. My fingers tighten on top of Aemon's, a deep sense of satisfaction blossoming in my chest, especially as I glance up at him, a smile on my lips as I take in his breathtaking features. So much time has passed, and it still feels like the first time. His hair's cropped to his ears, the first time it's ever been so short. After a torturous battle, he'd finally agreed to cut his glorious mane to fit better in society, and he'd allowed me to style his hair in a modern way. Though I miss his long hair, this new style best showcases his strong jaw, sharp cheekbones, and his otherworldly eyes. That isn't to say I'm the only one noticing his striking looks. Everywhere we go, the female gaze drifts to him, admiring him appreciatively and sometimes blatantly desiring him. Rome isn't a prudish city. Here, women take pride in their sexuality and do not shy away from making their intentions clear, as has been the case plenty of times since we've relocated to this part of the world. Despite the fact that I cannot help but be jealous sometimes, I know my Aemon. I know the type of male he is, and in spite of his legendary reputation as the most savage warrior in the realm, his chief quality is his loyalty, his unwavering devotion. From the beginning he's been mine just like I've been his, wholly, irrevocably, eternally. Catching me staring, he gives me his signature smile, a dimple appearing in his left cheek. Unable to stop, I raise myself on the tips of my toes, brushing my lips lightly against the small indentation.
A public display, my love.
He arches a brow.
Who are you, and what have you done with my wife?
He teases. You know what they say. I murmur softly against his skin. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. I say as I slide my hand suggestively over his pronounced pectorals. He's wearing an average Roman garment, just as I am, nothing too luxurious so as not to draw unwanted attention. But even in the most ordinary garb, he exudes pure strength and sensuality. He chuckles at my words, a rich, deep sound that reverberates in my being. Immediately, though, his gaze turns serious, just as it grows heated.
Does this mean what I think it means?
He asks in a thick, husky voice. I nod slowly, licking my lips as my eyes find his.
Damnation.
He curses, his features growing taut.
We need to get home. Now.
He declares tightly, his voice full of need, one that steadily mounts in my own body. Just as he's about to pull me into a darkened corner to avoid being seen, a cart rolls down the street, its driver nowhere to be seen. Aemon tugs me to the side, expertly avoiding the impact, but there's no one to defend the people running away from its disastrous path. Screams erupt in the air as everyone tries to duck or search for cover, the cart wreaking havoc in its advance. Do something, I whisper, panic growing in my breast as I watch the ensuing mayhem. Everyone is running for their lives, concerned only with their welfare. and there are those who cannot fend for themselves. The children. There are two on the ground at the end of the street, one seemingly already injured and unable to move. An old man is by their side, moving slowly, too slowly. Distressed, I turn to him, pleading with my eyes. He purses his lips, and the seconds tick. I know he doesn't want to use his powers, has tried not to do so since the last disaster in Asia Minor. He'd promised himself he wouldn't intervene in human lives, just like I did. After all, we'd been through enough to know that oftentimes our interference, no matter how helpful, would only be regarded with suspicion and animosity. Humankind is capable of great kindness, but it's also capable of the worst atrocities. Yet at this moment, I can only see the helpless children and their imminent deaths, and as always, I can't help my traitorous heart. "Please help them," I whisper. He hisses in anguish, the dilemma eating at him. For despite his rough and curt manner, my Eamon has a heart of gold. With a wave of his hand, the cart comes to a halt, just a few peds away from the children. Without waiting for his approval, I hurry forward, only one goal on my mind, to make sure the children are fine. When the cart stops, the old man curses as he takes one of the children in his arms, leaving the injured one behind. The boy can't be more than 4 or 5. My heart breaks as I see the tears on his ruddy cheeks, the dirt on his clothes and the caked blood on his legs where he'd hurt himself. "Shh." I drop to my knees in front of him, my hands on his shoulders in an attempt to calm him. "It's fine. You're all right," I coo softly. "You're going to be all right." I don't have to turn to feel Eamon behind me, his gaze boring a hole in my back.
"Senna, don't."
He grits his teeth, the command curt. Whipping my head around, I level him with my gaze. "I'm not one of your soldiers, General," I tell him resolutely. Before he can act, I bring my hands over the little boy's injuries, my palms humming with energy as it transfers into his skin. Slowly, his skin starts melding, his injuries healing in seconds. When I'm done, only caked blood remains. "Where are your parents?" I ask gently. He's still crying, his sobs making it hard for me to understand him. Yet as I lay my hand against his temple, I see the images, identifying his mother within moments.
"Sella."
Eamon calls my name, his tone firm but apologetic. I ignore him as I simply gather the little boy in my arms, marching forward and wading my way through the crowd as I focus on his mother. It doesn't take long for me to locate her. She's pale, her features torn with worry as she looks right and left, undoubtedly searching for her boy. "He's safe," I assure her, as I stop in front of her. Her eyes widen as she takes me in, her hands reaching out to take the child out of my arms. "My baby!" she cries out, scanning him from head to toe. "Thank you, thank you." She bows her head to me. I wave my hand, merely giving her a smile as I turn to leave. Yet, it only takes a moment for my nightmare to come to fruition. "She healed him!" she yells, and suddenly, the crowd stops. "She healed my son! She healed his clubfoot!" she declares. "A goddess among us!" My breath hitches in alarm as images of the last incident flash through my mind. The mob of angry people, the masses of worship, the unending conflict.
"I've got you,"
a masculine voice murmurs against my hair. His hands around my shoulders, he lays a kiss on my brow as our surroundings change. In just a second, we've left the busy forum only to be back to our domus. Opening my eyes and noting my surroundings, I step away from him. My emotions are still raw, and against all attempts to the contrary, my longing bursts through the surface, my heart aching with the hopelessness of the future.
"Sella, You promised you wouldn't. We promised we wouldn't.
Aemon says as he follows me to the peristylium. Despite the size of our domus, we are the only ones living here. No servants, no staff, no slaves. We are quite possibly the only ones to live like this, in spite of our wealth. But it goes beyond the ethical implications of Nexum or slavery, both of which are as distasteful to me as they are to Aemon. It simply comes down to the fact that if anyone worked or lived with us, we would risk discovery. Like today. Like every time we decide to use our powers.
You know what happened last time.
He sighs as he comes behind me. I swallow hard. I do know, and that is the problem. The constant predicament. It isn't my nature to turn a blind eye, yet helping means potentially getting crucified for it. I can't help it, I whisper, doing my best to keep the pain from my voice. I see them suffering and I just can't. I shake my head. Columns surround the small garden of the peristylium, colourful sculptures at every corner. Since we've moved here, I've dedicated my time to growing herbs and other medicinal plants that I then donate to poorer parts of the city. Another thing that risks our discovery. Another thing I cannot stop myself from doing. I march forward to the Excedra at the end of the peristylium, a semi-open room that has a direct view of the gardens. The main wall has been encased with a bronze mirror that captures all the activity around. I have my affinity for gardening, while Aemon has his own, watching me. From the corner of my eye, I spot his determined stride as he comes towards me.
Sella.
When he sees I don't respond, he simply flashes himself in front of me, his hands resting over my shoulders as he gently stops me.
Talk to me, Sella.
He murmurs, his lovely eyes taking me in.
You know what we promised.
He continues, his voice gentle, entirely losing the edge from earlier. I nod slowly, accepting the blame is mine. Whenever we end up doing something like this, I'm always the instigator, always the one pushing him. I'm sorry, I whisper.
It was the boy, wasn't it? That's why you did it.
I avert my gaze as I give him another nod, unable to find the strength to reply with my words for fear my voice would crack with pain.
Ah, Sella.
Aemon rasps, bringing me to his body for a tight hug.
I'm so sorry, my love. So, so very sorry.
He speaks harshly, and I note the same frustration, the same agony, marring his voice, too. He's not indifferent, but how could he be? It's not something only I have lost. We both did.
Do you regret it?
He inquires softly, his big palms cupping the sides of my face as he draws back to look at me.
Do you regret choosing me?
I shake my head. You know that isn't something I would ever be able to regret. I tell him honestly, though the echoes of pain are still there. Breaking free of his embrace, I turn to the bronze mirror, gazing at my reflection and his in the back. Do you? I pause, fear flickering to life inside of me. I've always considered myself a rational female, just as I've always known he was settling by choosing me. After all, he was Aemon, the greatest warrior who ever lived, the most feared one. Before me, he had a life of glory, his name in the history books, his reputation as awe-striking as it was terrifying. He was Aemon, a legend in itself, and I was Sella, just Sella, poor reclusive Sella. Do you regret meeting me, Aemon? I wet my lips, my eyes finding his in the mirror. There are so many women in this world, so many who could give you more than I can.
No,
he states categorically as he comes behind me.
How could you ever say something like that, Sella? How could you even think about it?
A sad smile pulls at my lips. I see the way they watch you. Want you. I whisper, my insecurities poking through, despite having full confidence in him. Yet it's in times like these when I'm reminded that I'm not whole, that I'm a healer, but I cannot heal the most important part of myself. It's in moments like these that I feel the greatest failure, like I'm not worthy to breathe the same air he breathes, let alone be his mate.
And I would never want them back. There is only you for me. From the first moment I laid eyes on you, Sella, you've been the center of my universe. Until you, I thought life and suffering were synonymous.
His breath fans my skin as he slowly undoes the girdle at my waist, before slipping the stola off my body. The material falls to the ground, leaving me bare in front of the mirror. His big hands are on my shoulders, slowly caressing me just as his mouth brushes against my neck. Holding his hand to the side, he materializes an unexpected item in his palm. My eyes grow wide as he gently places the necklace I'd seen at the forum around my neck.
Before you, I only knew violence. I was born to bloodshed and destruction, and I let it shape who I was. I embraced it.
He kisses my skin as he fastens the necklace around my neck, the metal cold against my feverish flesh. My breath catches in my throat, goosebumps erupting all over my skin as I react to his proximity and his molten voice, my arousal building as my body becomes primed for his.
Before you, I was chaos and ruin.
He continues to speak, hypnotizing me with his voice and squashing all my doubts.
Until you showed me the alternative, until you showed me there was joy to be had in the most mundane moments.
He rasps, bringing his arms around my waist and holding me tightly to him.
How could I want anyone else when I am, only because you are? I exist for you, just as I exist because of you.
He breathes harshly against me. His voice becomes increasingly anguished, the emotions pouring out of him as he holds me so close to his body, as if he's trying to merge us into one. Slowly, I bring my hands on top of his, squeezing lightly just as I squeeze my eyes shut to keep the tears at bay. We've come this far, but what about the sacrifices of the past? What about everything we've lost, or the harm we've caused because of our choice? I love you, Eamon. I tell him with all the emotion I can muster. I've loved you for so long, and I'll continue to love you for as long as my essence lives on. Unclasping his hands, I bring one of his palms to my chest, covering my breast as I urge him to feel the beats of my heart and the unsubdued pulsations of my soul, every little flicker of life that is for him and him alone.
Sella,
he groans.
My darling Sella.
He whispers in my ear as his other hand slides down my stomach, his fingers dipping between my legs.
Look at us,
he commands, and my eyes meet his in the mirror.
Look how mad I am for you,
he says as he strokes me lightly, coating his digits in my arousal before slipping one thick finger inside of me.
Look how ravenous I am for you and you alone, Selamina.
Eamon, I moan loudly, arching into him and rubbing myself against the hard planes of his body.
Selamina, Selamina.
He chants as euphoria builds in his veins, in my veins, in everything that I am, only for him and with him. As if I burned, I drop the staff from my grasp, taking a step back as I attempt to regulate my erratic breathing. My pulse is through the roof, my entire body humming with foreign awareness, just as liquid pools low between my legs. The arousal I'm feeling an echo of the one from the vision. Dear God, what was that? What the hell did I see? Heavy steps thud down the stairs, and I hurry to arrange the cane in the same position Mr. Nicholson had left it, before stepping back and resuming my seat on the sofa. Plastering a big smile on my face, I turn to him, doing my best to seem as normal as possible. I fear I've imposed on you for far too long. I make the excuse as I rise. I should head back now. I'm sure people are wondering where I am. He purses his lips, regarding me suspiciously, and for a moment I wonder if he knows I touched his cane.
That is fine, Darcy. I am glad you visited me, and I hope you will do so again.
Of course. I nod effusively. Now that I know we are family, how can I not? I offer some platitude as I inch my way towards the door. He nods slowly, pensively.
I also hope you will carefully consider what we've discussed today, and be careful with the hands. If you ever find yourself in danger or in need of something, please don't hesitate to reach out to me.
Thank you. I force a smile as I exit his home. By chance, I spot Mr. Meow on the paved road leading to the main street, and taking him in my arms, I pick up the pace. Helena's voice echoes through the house as she makes her displeasure known at my sudden departure. But given what I just experienced, I can only push forward, needing to be alone in the privacy of my room. That vision, that damned vision, it had been me, under yet another name, with Eamon. But that had not been the most striking thing. I'd seen my appearance, identical to my current one, and I'd seen my naked flesh in the mirror. On my body, right above my heart, there had been no birthmark. At one point in time, I had been Sela, Eamon's wife and lover. Sela, with no mark and no destiny of greatness. I'd been just Sela, and Eamon still loved me.
Chapter 17.
Wake up, Sleeping Beauty.
A deep rumble penetrates my sleepy state. Turning around in my bed, I swat a pair of hands aside as I moan my displeasure. Let me sleep, I grumble.
Wake up, darling. There's much to be done today.
Darling. Only one person calls me darling. My eyes snap open as I push myself into a sitting position. He's on the right side of my bed, a lazy smile on his face as he regards me. Immediately, I hug the sheet to my chest, even though I'm wearing a thick cotton nightgown. You're back.
Just in time for the festival.
He winks at me. What festival? I frown.
Fairy festival. I'm sure you must have heard of it. It's the only time of the year when the town comes together and forgets about previous animosities. And even better.
He pauses, a mischievous grin on his face. My brows shoot up in question.
It's a costume festival.
What do you mean?
You'll get to dress in fancy period dresses and dance like it's the 19th century. It'll be fun. You'll see. But first, we need to find you something to wear.
He says as he pulls the sheet from me. I squeak in surprise, my cheeks reddening as the sheet slips from my hands. Don't! I jump to grab it back.
How did I offend your maidenly sensibilities this time, Darcy, darling?
He drawls in amusement. I'm not wearing a brassiere, I admit as I avert my gaze, but not before I see his dip to my breasts. Hugging my arms around my chest, I try to face him. Wait outside, I tell him, motioning to the door with a push of my chin. I need to get dressed. For a moment, he doesn't move, simply watching me with a dangerous twinkle in his eyes.
As you wish,
he eventually says, giving me a mock bow as he exits the room. The moment the door closes, I mutter a curse under my breath. No locked door can hold Caleb, can it? Shaking my head, I go to my luggage as I rummage for something to wear. Since he'd said I would try on dresses, I opt for clothing I could easily wear underneath so I won't need to undress. My way of telling him he will not win in that regard. I end up choosing a beige t-shirt and a pair of white mid-calf pants. As I put my clothes on, I cannot stop my thoughts from straying to the day before and how my meeting with Mr. Nicholson had gone. Yet despite the seemingly prejudiced information he'd given me, it had been the vision that had rattled me the most. That, and how the vision had come about. The stone. It must be a magical object if it was capable of showing me a previous life. One where I still had this odd healing ability, but no mark to show for it. A life where I was still Aemon's. I swallow hard as I still in front of the mirror while rinsing my mouth. I stare at my reflection, and I cannot help but remember a similar incident in the vision with Aemon. He'd touched me. Intimately. And it had been glorious. Good Lord, my cheeks burn just thinking about it. Out of everything I could analyze from that vision, that intimate moment is the one I cannot stop thinking about, the one that haunts me as does his touch, because I crave it more than anything else. Whether I am Sella, Elizabeth, or Darcy, my feelings for him do not change. He's in my heart, my soul, my very blood. My fingers linger over my left breast, somehow still able to feel the heat of his palm on my skin, his lips on my neck, and his fingers buried deep in. Get a hold of yourself, Darcy, I tell myself as I splash some water on my face. But the truth is that I am absolutely wrecked, and the only culprit is a demon. Yet is Aemon just a demon? If what I'd seen had been real, then the Aemon that had been my husband had not been evil. He'd been honorable and devoted, nothing like the evil entity Rhiannon and Mr. Nicholson are making him out to be. Certainly nothing like someone who would kill me in cold blood. He'd loved me, of that I am sure. He'd loved me as Sella, and he'd loved me as Elizabeth, too. Once again, though the information piles up, I find myself even more confused. Rationally, I don't think I can trust anyone. But if I look within me, my intuition is to go with Aemon. Always. Just then, a knock at my door startles me, and I blush furiously as I remember Caleb. The man courting me. The man I should be thinking about. Not some demon who may or may not have the power to influence my mind. And yet another conundrum arises. Though Aemon undoubtedly has a claim on my heart due to everything that I've seen and experienced in the past, I cannot deny that I feel something for Caleb, too. He's charming, intense, and a little dangerous. It's to a degree that my heart is just as confused as my mind. Yes, my instinct is to trust Aemon, but the same instinct wants to give Caleb a chance. Live in the moment with him. Damn it. I curse in frustration. Do I focus on the past with a potentially dangerous demon, banking everything on the few snippets that may or may not be real? Or do I focus on the present and the future? On Caleb.
Darcy, are you done?
I take one last look in the mirror before I head outside, though my heart still remains split in two. Where are we going?
While you were sleeping the morning away, I've already gone through the old clothes in the attic and have selected a few that would fit you so you can try them on.
He tells me, swinging his arms around my shoulders and leading me further down the hallway. The room he'd prepared is two doors down from his bedroom, and I appreciate that he'd been thoughtful about not making me uncomfortable by arranging everything in his own room. So, what happens at this festival?
It's an occasion for everyone to be merry.
He tells me with a smile.
It was first celebrated in the early 1800s to honor Mrs. Creed for her involvement in the town and with the peasant families. They used to call her the fairy.
He chuckles, almost as if reminiscing about a fond memory. That sounds fun. I smile. I'm curious what you picked, I say as I survey the many dresses laid out for me. There's also a divider at the end of the room, and he gives me a sheepish smile when I look at him curiously. You can be quite sweet when you put your mind to it, I praise gently.
Only for you,
he whispers, coming a little closer. Before I can anticipate what he will do, he brushes his lips lightly across my forehead. My heart does a somersault in my chest, heat traveling up my cheeks as I feel myself growing flustered. And there it is, my main conundrum. How can I claim to be in love with Eamon, yet react like this to Caleb? Alternatively, how can I say I'm falling for Caleb while holding the same torch for Eamon? Can one person even love two people, equally? Before, I would have said no. Now, I no longer know.
Why don't you start with that one?
He points to a pink gown. Are these really from the 19th century? The quality of the silk is absolutely breathtaking. Caleb nods.
Most are what the Creeds left behind. No one touched them after, so they should be in good shape.
They are. These are wonderful, Caleb. I breathe out in wonder.
Let's see how they look on you, then.
He directs me to the divider, telling me he will be the judge. Aren't you quite bossy? I joke as I take off my shirt. Why should you decide what I wear?
Because I'm the main audience, darling.
He drawls in that cocky way of his.
If you're dressing up for anyone, it's me.
You? I take a step outside the divider, narrowing my eyes at him. Has anyone told you how arrogant you are? His eyes sparkle.
Has anyone told you how fucking sexy you are?
My eyes widen just as my mouth forms an O, no sound coming out. I stare at him, blinking once, twice. The third time I squeal as I jump behind the divider again. Gazing down, I note that thankfully I still had my brassiere on, but it does nothing to alleviate my embarrassment. You're an asshole, Caleb, I yell out. His laughter echoes in the room, and it seems like my little blunder has given him plenty of material to tease me with now. I quickly put on the dress, forgoing a corset. Done, I grumble as I exit, doing a pitiful twirl in front of him. He purses his lips, tapping his finger against his chin as he considers me.
Next.
He declares, getting another dress and placing it in my arms. I give him a deadly glare, but I trudge my way back, putting on the next one. It goes on like this for another hour. I never realized how hard it was to please Caleb. At this point, we're running out of dresses, and he hasn't liked any. What about this one? I ask as I come out a while later. To my surprise, I find him waiting for me with a cart full of food, tea, and even dessert. He stops the cart in the middle of the room as he straightens his spine, his eyes roving all over my figure. I'd put on a dark blue gown that I'd thought complemented my eyes quite well, and as he peruses me from head to toe, I rather believe he likes it too. You like it? I whisper as I step closer, somehow needing to hear his confirmation. He gives a brisk nod, his Adam's apple bobbing up and down as he regards me. Leaving the cart behind, he takes a few steps towards me, his fingers going to my hair as he tucks a few strands behind my ear.
You look magnificent, Darcy.
He compliments me in a thick voice. His eyes come to rest on my face, caressing me with his honeyed gaze.
So very beautiful.
He continues, almost as if in a trance. I didn't realize you found me beautiful. I blush as I push my chin down. He'd told me he liked me and that he found me appealing, but this is the first time he called me beautiful. He clears his throat.
Then it is my mistake. You are the most beautiful woman I've ever seen, Darcy.
He whispers as he takes my hand, bringing my knuckles to his mouth for a kiss. I'm rooted to the spot as I stare at him, wondering what it would feel like if I just gave in, just for a taste. If I let him touch more of me just as he is touching the skin on my hand, with innate sensuality accompanied by the utmost care, reverence. He might be dangerous to my virtue, but for the first time I see in his eyes that he would cherish it too. Cherish me.
Let's eat,
he suddenly says, moving away from me. I try not to show my disappointment as I quickly take off the dress so I won't sully it before I join him at the makeshift table.
What did you do while I was away?
He asks casually as we start eating. I spoke with Rhiannon. I start, giving him a quick rundown of my discussion with Rhiannon, telling him everything but the fact that I am familiar with Aemon. I also tell him about my visit to Mr. Nicholson, and the fact that he'd given me some conflicting information. He nods thoughtfully as he listens, and it's clear this is not new information for him. You knew, didn't you? About what's happening in Fairydale. About everything. I accuse lightly, taking in his features and his lack of reaction to even the most shocking bits, like the fact that Mr. Nicholson is my grandfather.
If I knew and did not tell you, it was for a reason.
His tone is serious as he meets my gaze.
I cannot make the decision for you, Darcy. I can only gently guide you.
Then what do you suggest I do? One wants to do a life-threatening ritual while the other wants some unknown blood rite. How am I to know what is right?
Do you have to do either?
He suddenly asks, shutting me up. My brows pinch together as I tilt my head in confusion. What do you mean?
You don't have to do anything if you don't want, Darcy. Why should you risk anything? Why is it your duty to do anything?
But isn't this demon evil? I probe, curious what he knows.
He might be.
He nods.
But did Lydia name the demon in her prophecy?
What?
To my knowledge, she never said what evil. She only said that there will be someone who will eradicate the evil in Fairydale. What if...
What if there's something else? Hope laces my voice.
I don't trust Nicholson. All his life, he's only ever been concerned about one thing. Power. I would encourage you to be careful around him.
He advises, and though he tries to come across as casual, I note the tightening of his fingers on his fork as he mentions the man by name. What about your grandmother? Should I trust her? He shakes his head, a smile pulling at his lips.
You should trust no one but yourself, Darcy. When the time comes, you will know what to do.
He assures me in a gentle tone. You have so much faith in me. I give a dry laugh.
Because I know you will make the right choice.
He states, his intense gaze on mine.
I trust you implicitly.
He tells me. That one sentence backed by so much emotion, my own feelings seem to awaken, my eyes getting teary for no reason. I blink away the dampness, offering him a small smile. We continue to eat, and Caleb regales me with more tales about Fairydale and its odd encounters. Yet, except for reinforcing his stance against Mr. Nicholson, he doesn't bring up the topic again, nor does he give me any additional information that could help me make more sense of everything. I trust you implicitly. Why does that feel like such a heavy burden on my shoulders, especially when I don't know if I trust myself? A few hours later, we are on our way out of the house towards the beach, where the celebrations are taking place, a few minutes north of the house. Caleb had described it as one of the most beautiful areas of Fairydale, where the marshes and the forest meet the sandy beach before the ocean takes over. Although I haven't had the opportunity to visit until now, I'm excited to see it, especially since he is accompanying me, the only thing that seems to make me feel safe lately. I'm wearing the deep blue gown while Caleb had settled for a basic ensemble that nonetheless makes him look dashing. Will your family be there too? He nods.
Katrina will be there for sure. I doubt my grandmother would, though. It's not really her scene.
As we get closer to the beach, music starts blasting through the air. A live orchestra, too? I ask in awe.
Of course. It's a veritable 19th century reenactment. Even better, the waltz was at the height of its popularity.
He winks at me. I've never waltzed before, I admit, as the music becomes louder, as does the crowd.
I wouldn't have been very happy if you had.
He murmurs softly, yet there's an unyielding quality to his tone. What? I flutter my lashes in surprise. Suddenly, Caleb comes to a halt as he positions himself in front of me.
The waltz is too intimate,
he states, his black eyes on mine.
It allows for the type of touch that could get a man killed.
What do you mean? I frown. One hand goes to the small of my back as he pulls me to him, our fronts mashed together.
Like this,
he drawls as he caresses my back slowly.
You're only allowed to be this close to me, darling.
He leans down to whisper in my ear.
You're only allowed to have my hands on your body like this.
You're being absurd. I laugh, trying to defuse the situation.
That's not me being absurd, darling. That's me at my boiling point.
I don't reply as I don't know how anyone could reply to that. You're being jealous for no reason, Caleb. I tell him lightly as I try to steer him towards the beach.
I have every reason to be jealous, Darcy. Every reason.
He states emphatically, his breath coming out in short spurts. Drawing back, he looks me in the eye for a moment, almost as if he's trying to convey everything with his gaze. The intensity, the desire, and the pure hunger rolling off him. Giving him a slow nod, I breathe out in relief when he resumes his place by my side, taking my hand in his and leading me to the festival. The music becomes louder, and soon we see all the townsfolk dancing and celebrating. Everyone is dressed in period clothes, cutting a striking picture. I can easily imagine how this would have looked almost 2 centuries ago. There are plenty of stands with food and beverages, as well as quite a few areas for games. The orchestra is to the side, playing different classical buoyant pieces as a few rows of men and women dance to the tunes. It's really the entire town, isn't it? There must be a few hundred people on the beach. You can barely spot a patch of empty land with how populated the area is.
I told you it's something Fairydale takes seriously. Everyone, whether young or old, loves this festival.
Why was Mrs. Creed so popular? I ask as I let my eyes roam around, taking in all the fun and the good disposition of the people. As we slowly make our way through the crowd, No one minds us. There are no strange looks, no odd whispers, nothing but merriment. Either everyone is too focused on the festival, or Mr. Nicholson had done a marvelous job of taking the attention off me. As it stands, no one even takes note of us.
She helped most of the families in town, whether with money, medicine, or by being there for them. She was like the big sister of the town, always ready to help.
That was very nice of her, considering the Creeds were so rich. No one would have held it against them if they never interacted with the town.
It's because they were so rich that it was unusual. They didn't differentiate in regards to skin color or amount of wealth, making everyone feel welcome.
It makes sense she would be celebrated then. I'm sure it must have been rare for those times.
Come,
he says, as he takes me to the first stand, buying me a type of Fairydale-specific dessert, a mix of fruits and rose jam.
There are fields of roses all around Fairydale. It's our local pride.
The seller declares as he hands me a little container. Nodding my thanks, I follow Caleb as he takes me to yet another stand, and then another, until my arms are full of Fairydale delicacies. Amusement enters his features as he sees me juggling the many dishes, so he seats me at a small table by the side, telling me to eat. You're not eating? I ask in between mouthfuls, noticing he's just watching me. He rests his chin in his palm as he gazes at me with deep satisfaction, as if he could get his fill just by looking at me. My cheeks color slightly, especially as his lips tip into an adoring smile.
Have I told you how cute you are when you eat?
He suddenly says, playfully tapping my nose with his finger. Earlier you said beautiful. I raise a challenging brow at him.
You're the best combination of beautiful, cute, and sexy, darling. Never doubt that. But now...
He pauses as his smile widens, his eyes roving all over my face.
Now you're so cute, I'd like nothing more than to eat you.
My eyes widen slightly, and before I know it, I push a piece of fruit into his mouth. There's plenty of food around. Besides, I'm not that edible. I grumble, flushing in embarrassment at my abysmal flirting skills. He releases a deep chuckle as he slowly chews on the fruit, yet his gaze tells me everything I need to know. For him, I am edible. When I'm done with the food, he takes the empty containers to the trash, getting me a cup of mulled wine.
Don't tell me you've also never had alcohol before.
He inquires when he sees me regard the glass with apprehension, smelling it while considering whether I should drink or not. Will it get me drunk? I ask as I look up at him. He shakes his head in amusement.
Go on, drink. Nothing will happen to you.
Trusting him, I take a small sip, then another one. There's an interesting flavor to it, and the combination of sweet and sour is potent on my senses. Before I know it, the cup is empty, and I give him a doe-eyed look as I ask for a refill. Ever the gentleman, Caleb indulges me, getting me another one. But when I'm done with that one, he tells me it's time to dance. Right at that moment, the Blue Danube starts playing. Though the sand is a little inconvenient to dance on, I forget all about it as Caleb sweeps me into the crowd of other dancers, losing ourselves among them. I may not be particularly familiar with the waltz, but with his lead, I don't think I need to know anything. Just how to let myself go and enjoy the moment. He holds me close to his body, too close. One hand hugs mine as he raises our arms in the air, while his other languidly touches my back, settling right above my hip. One dip, and it could slip into dangerous territory. But seeing the wicked gleam in his eyes, I know he's aware of it. He's in fact tempting fate as he caresses me softly, his fingers brushing over the light material of the dress, his touch searing even through the clothes. He moves his hand slowly, following the same rhythm of the waltz. As he pushes me back, his hand dips. As he pulls me towards him, it goes up. "You're incorrigible," I tell him, channeling my teacher's tone. Yet my lips are in a perpetual smile as he spins me onto the sand-filled beach, my cheeks flushed, my heart pounding relentlessly. The light breeze of the afternoon brushes against my skin, the cool wind doing nothing to ease the heat building in my body. From the wine or his proximity, I don't know. He has an equally carefree smile on his face, and though his eyes maintain the same intensity as before, as if he would eat me if he could, his features are lighter than they've ever been. So much so that I can't help the feeling of déjà vu that takes shape in my breast, an eternity converging into one moment. This moment. The music becomes a faraway sound, drowning in the distance as my focus dims until he turns into my sole focus. Everything to my right or left is a blur. The sounds of the crowd are all but drowned out as I get lost in his eyes. He twirls me around, every time fitting me tighter to his body, to the point that I feel every hard edge of him. His muscles bulge beneath his clothing, but there is another part of him that makes me blush to the roots of my hair. He notices it too, as he brings his mouth to my ear, nibbling at my flesh.
"My shy little maiden,"
he coos gently.
"This is what you do to me, Darcy."
He draws as he holds me to him, his hardness fitted against my belly.
"You make the blood in my veins boil with a need to possess you, to be the only man to ever touch your skin, to sear myself on your flesh."
A shiver envelops me, his hot breath caressing my earlobe, his heated words making me tremble in his arms.
"Will you be mine, Darcy, darling?"
He draws back to study my reaction, and as I find myself staring at him, I cannot deny this maddening connection between us, this attraction that borders on the animalistic. When I'm with him, all sense leaves me until I'm a mere pool of sensations, his touch creating small waves that ripple through the entire surface. Words fail me as I can only look at him, my lips parted, my pulse drumming in my ears. There's music in the background, and as the waltz comes to an end, the orchestra switches to a more lively tune. Yet, even as Caleb leads me into a brisker dance, increasing the tempo and swirling me all around, I cannot find it in me to answer him. Not because I do not have an answer. My reaction to him is the prime indication that I do. But because I feel so lost, yet so found, so foreign in my own flesh, yet so at home in his arms. It's an alarming dichotomy, and one that scares me with its implications. It makes me believe that I'm more, that I'm not just orphaned little Darcy, the lonely English teacher who's never tried to do anything daring in her life. No, when I'm with him like this, when my spirit soars up high, I feel special. I feel capable of anything.
"You are,"
Caleb states, as he comes closer in the rhythm of the dance, his breath caressing my lips.
"Mine, mine, 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 Darcy,"
he chants, his eyes a cloudy gathering of lust, desire, and something more. Something I should be intimately acquainted with, yet is ever so elusive. Just as I'm about to look deeper into myself to give him an answer, a loud cry erupts in the air.
"Duck!"
Caleb yells, pushing me to the ground just as another howl resounds. The music stops, replaced by human screams as everyone starts running and panicking. "What?" The word is barely out of my mouth when I see four winged creatures descend onto the beach. "What's happening?" I ask in alarm. Caleb gathers me to his chest, doing his best to shield me from the ongoing chaos.
"Gargoyles,"
Fuck.
Gargoyles? You mean...
Yes, those.
He nods to one of the winged creatures stepping onto the beach, one clawed hand reaching out and grabbing one of the men in its path. Just as I think it's going to throw him away, the gargoyle wraps its big hand around the body, bringing it to its mouth and popping the head off, slowly chewing on it as it lets its gaze roam around the beach.
We need to leave. Now.
Caleb says as he helps me to my feet. Before I can ask him what's going on, he grabs the hem of my dress, tearing it in one go.
We can't have anything slowing us down.
Grabbing my hand, he tugs me after him, hurrying to the path that leads back to the main road and to the house. I'm still staring at the big creature munching on the human head, my eyes bulging in my head at the sight, disbelief filling me to the brim. Thank God for Caleb and his quick acting, because I'm barely starting to recover from my shock.
Fuck.
He suddenly stops, and I note that the other gargoyles have surrounded the beach, each slowly inching their way towards us while feasting on the crowd of people in their way. They're killing everyone, I whisper in horror. We have to do something, Caleb. We can't just... My voice trembles as I see more blood, more decapitated bodies.